The Guardian.
The Guardian Football Weekly Extra podcast with James Richardson, coming up.
Football Weekly Extra, going out all around the world, just like the Olympic torch. On today's to-do list, discuss the Champions League quarter-finals with three English teams through to the semis. We look back on the best moments of the past few days. The Theo Walcott run, the Torres goal, the pigeon-frightening De Rossi spot kick. Elsewhere, no Spain, no gain. Sid Lowe reports from Madrid. And interest rates are falling. It must meet my Italian news section. We've the latest on football's weirdest league, the Championship, your posts, and a look forward to Man United Arsenal and the rest of the weekend's Premier League action. All that on today's Football Weekly Extra.
Stand by for Guardian Football Weekly Extra. James Richardson.
Hello all. Welcome on board. Floating happily here in near-Earth orbit like a Daniele De Rossi penalty, etc. Sean Ingle today.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Kevin McCarra.
Hello, James.
Hi, Kevin. And James Dart.
Hi, James.
Hi, nice to have you back, James. It's been a while.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You guys have all been watching lots of Champions League action in the last few days, haven't you?
I was at Chelsea at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday night.
You picked a winner there, didn't you?
As always.
Whereas you were probably at Anfield.
And Old Trafford. But we can forget Old Trafford.
Right.
That was kind of the warm down from the excitement of the night before.
Well, it was excitement, wasn't it? What do you want to talk about first with this? There's so many things. Liverpool going through. A lot of fans coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, you see, Rafa's rotation has paid off in the end. Seems to me the only rotation was that was having a different referee that paid off for them.
Well, the referee in the first leg paid off for him as well.
Well, it did, but he might have given that as a penalty. He might have ignored that as a penalty. Anyway, but
I know I'm just being silly, but I thought it was a penalty. You tell me, you think that wasn't a penalty, Touré? And
I didn't see anything that particularly constituted a penalty.
I thought it was stupid.
It was.
I thought it was a penalty. I thought both were a penalty, but I mean, I bore all our listeners by talking about video replays. But if ever there was a case for video replay, it was, you know, the Champions League, Arsenal v Liverpool, and also the Manchester United Roma game last night. It clearly wasn't a penalty; it was given.
Oh, I don't know about that. But anyway,
but I think the fault was Cole Touré, an experienced player, panicking,
right,
and letting Babel get inside him, and then instead of passing him on, sort of bundling into him. It's just silly.
Where do you stand in that situation on taking that incredibly cynical view, as with the Theo Walcott goal? Someone should have taken him out, in theory, up the field and taken a yellow. So with the same with either Fabregas and Calatoria
on
Babel as well outside the box. Well, very half-heartedly, I'd suggest.
Well, it's quite wonderful, mind you, Liverpool's supposed to be ultra-defensive. But wide open to counter-attack. I mean, Walcott did it really well. You'd have expected Liverpool half the pitch to be full of Liverpool players, which it wasn't.
But mentioning the Walcott goal, an absolutely astonishing bit of action that, no?
Fantastic, yeah, brilliant. I mean, four men and four good names too, Mascherano and Hepia and so on.
Do you think, Kevin, this is the start of, you know, a wonderful career, or do you think it's a flash in the pan? I mean, I always remember going back to 1994 World Cup final. There's a guy called Viola came on in extra time and was sensationally beat everyone, had all the tricks. You know, the next day, that's all we talked about apart from Baggio's penalty, and then he disappeared. Now, Walcott, you know, he's shown signs this season of. But hasn't, you know, that was the first real, you know, gee whiz moment. And do you think, you know, he will kick on now?
I think the trouble is, of course, that once people recognise the danger, then they start crowding you. And I've seen that already in some games. Walcott has maybe two men in front of him and his pace is nullified. So he's got to develop lots of other attributes, because what he did the other night will not be allowed very often over the course of his career.
He's still a very weak player, I think, in terms of he needs to get down the gym, seriously. I mean, I think if you saw in the Liverpool-Arsenal game on
Saturday...
He needs
some of Sean's wheat drinks.
He needs some serious guns building up here, I think. I mean, seriously, he was out-muscled massively at the Emirates on Saturday. And, okay, yes, this was an incredible run, but you feel for him a little bit, because this fantastic moment in his career, almost a career-defining moment, and it gets lost somewhat in the fact that Arsenal blew it within about 45 seconds.
But also, Torres' goal was lost as well. Amazing, yeah. An amazing game where you almost forget these moments.
You do.
Well, I didn't see any of that because I was at Chelsea.
Well, listen, just before we move on from Arsenal...
from Chelsea.
There's plenty of other things to discuss there. I mean, we seem to reach our annual Arsene Wenger meltdown moment, poor chap. And you can understand why he was a little bit upset. But are Arsenal going to borrow your expression, kick on from this, or are they going to fall apart?
It was really interesting to hear William Gallas say that they've overperformed this season, which perhaps is true.
Wow.
They started the season at, I think, 10 or 11 to 1 for the league. But if you go back to, you know, end of January, start of February, they were in, you know, most of the competitions. They were flying high. I think it was a mistake to field that weakened team at Old Trafford. A mistake, perhaps, to field that team at Spurs. But perhaps more so, not to rotate enough. And it's very interesting now that bookmakers make it just 5-4, so pretty much even money, that Wenger never wins another trophy at Arsenal, you know, which is an amazing price. But they haven't won for anything for 3 years. So.
What was the mistake not for him to have spent more money in January when they were in this position of strength?
Well, we mentioned this on Monday, and it's interesting that, who was it, Laughing Gaz posted in with some quotes from his friend who couldn't be bothered to post in, JJCC, who explains that when Wenger was in France, apparently he considered Marseille's wealth unfairly gained. I think you mentioned this, Kevin, on Monday. Refused to compete with them on a kind of moral basis, and then decided that when he came second, that was almost like a moral victory. And apparently there's this kind of perceived injustice. It's something that remains with him to this day, and was the reason that he originally went to Japan, to kind of flee the throwing around of money.
He's a complex man. In one sense, he's incredibly stubborn. He wants to win only in his terms.
Right.
On the other hand, he's kind of altruistic. And I think the guy mentioned the financial doping thing, which we took as a kind of throwaway remark from Wenger, but I mean, maybe he is genuinely outraged by it. But the question is, if so, will he be a, it sounds impossible, but will he be a hindrance to Arsenal? Not in terms of the beautiful football they play, but to living up to the money they have and the audience they have and the position they have in London. Because a lot can be done with Arsenal. And maybe he's the man to do it, but I think there has to be some change in developing the squad.
Is there any chance that he's on some kind of spending-related contract, i.e. his bonus is bigger the less he spends?
I don't think so. I mean, I think last summer reached almost absurd levels of making a profit in the transfer market, which is very clever, but I think one or two players bought in might have helped.
I think, I mean, Arsenal have got tremendous potential, and they have had for several years. The trouble with potential is it has to be realised at some point, and you know, it's going to be another win this season, which is a huge shame, because, you know, I'm not an Arsenal fan, but if I had a season ticket, I'd, you know, it'd be them and United. Yeah. It'd be the two you go and watch.
I mean, we should say, I mean, no matter what you say about Wenger and Arsenal, there were levels that they reached against Liverpool in midweek that were far beyond, maybe in England only Manchester United could hope to compete. Liverpool were nowhere near as good a football team. Well, they won for other reasons.
We should really talk about one of the teams that's actually going through to the semi-finals now. So how about Liverpool, who are going to be facing Chelsea, who are abject, to be fair, against Fenerbahce?
They were. It was a very strange match, because Chelsea started off well. They scored, you know, after 4 minutes, and they hit the post. It was very interesting how the fans clearly don't think much of Avram Grant.
Do you think?
Well, it's obvious, but how it's now becoming more obvious, the silences were there, but also they were singing things like, you know, we're supposed to be at home.
But there was a lot of booing, and I couldn't work out if it was coming from the Chelsea fans or the away support.
A bit of both, but, you know, there were certainly lots of people around me were slagging off Didier Drogba. You know, Drogba, when he went down with his wrist injury that miraculously recovered 10 seconds later in the first half, everyone around me was going, you know, well, I won't use the language, but involved, you know, sort of, you know, tarts and the like. Second half, it was the same thing.
Did you go with Barry or what? Sorry, go on.
No, but there was lots and lots of unhappiness and unease. And Chelsea, it was difficult because they were going to go through with the 1-0, but they had six men, pretty much, whenever Fenerbahce in their own half, six men covering the edge of the box with three midfielders blocking everything off. And it was incredibly negative against a Fenerbahce team that, apart from the last 10 minutes, never really threatened.
Yeah, really. And they were somewhat disappointing. Chelsea then facing Liverpool, you presumably are not going to, especially given the presence, presumably you wouldn't be backing them.
No, I mean, the first two haven't been very good games.
Yes.
It's almost like, you know, watching Sister Act 1, then 2, and then 3 comes along. I mean,
would you do that?
Why would you do that? But you never know, they might surprise
us. I don't know, because exactly, Arsenal-Liverpool, everyone was saying, oh, this is going to be deadly dull, 1-1, or go straight to penalties, but it was a brilliant game.
I think Liverpool might go for a little bit more. They've shown signs of being more expansive under Benitez.
They have more weapons as well.
3 or 4 weeks, possibly. Mm. I mean, you know, it's always wonderful how, you know, Benitez was able to get under Mourinho's skin, and I wonder whether they'll be able to do the same for Grant.
The fact that Chelsea have the second leg at home, how much difference will that make?
I think an enormous difference. Thinking back to last year when it went to penalties, the intimidating effect of Anfield. People joke about it in blogs and so on, but if you were there and if you were a Chelsea player, you suffered. Jose Mourinho, one of the strangest decisions of his life, gave the first penalty to Arjen Robben. A good technical player, but perhaps not the steadiest of nerve for that occasion, and of course it was saved. Anyway, but this time, return at Stamford Bridge. London's not quite so noisy or passionate, but by heavens, those Chelsea fans must have been waiting for this. And I think Liverpool will be really pushed to get through.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Meanwhile, in the other side of the draw, you've got Man United going through against Roma. No surprise there. Their 11th straight win at home in the Champions League for United, which is a new record for the competition. I have to say that Sir Alex took a bit of a risk, though, didn't he? He benched various top players, Rooney, Cristiano Ronaldo, And very nearly got caught out by it, because if De Rossi's penalty had gone in, you would have seen some very shaky faces around Old Trafford.
Yeah, but in case of emergency, break glass and bring on Cristiano Ronaldo and Rooney and Paul Scholes. And
still,
the bench,
playing with fire, though, to let yourself go 1-0.
I think that's overrating Roma, because it wasn't a penalty for starts, and they were half-hearted in their attacks.
Right. But it's all about playing the percentages. You know, United have got a huge game against Arsenal on. Yeah. The bookmakers made United 1-25 on to go through. I mean, it was a smart thing to do. Now he's got Ronaldo fairly fresh. He's got Rooney fairly fresh to take on Arsenal on Sunday.
Owen Hargreaves must be tuckered out after playing up front, apparently, indeed pretty much everywhere but in goal. He was all over the place.
He was terrific last night. Very, very good. even put in the cross for the goal. You couldn't keep him out of the game. It was really very impressive.
Well, shall we talk quickly then, before we close off part one, about Man United Arsenal, which is coming up this weekend, of course, at Old Trafford. United can go, 6 points clear if they win, because Chelsea won't face Wigan until Monday. Intriguingly, Arsenal were actually 5 points clear in the Premier League last time they visited Old Trafford. That was in the FA Cup. They lost 4-0. And since when, they've won just two of their last 12 games in all competitions. So a real watershed moment. If they're looking to bounce back from Liverpool, you couldn't get a bigger game. But is there any way they can get up for this one?
I think the Premier League's gone. I think it's a matter of saying that our season's been a bit of a mess. Let's try and have one memorable occasion before we call it a day. But whether they have the energy left, I don't know. I don't know. Is Matthew Flamini ruled out from that game? I didn't catch up with injury news, but he's a huge loss in midfield because of that dynamism. You bring in Gilberto Silva, captain of Brazil, but he slows the game too much.
I think Gilberto is more than that. I think he's had a shocking season. He's completely gone. He's not just slowing the game down. There's nothing, there's no drive. Taking the captaincy away from him seems to have ripped his heart out. And Flamini, to be honest, hasn't played as well, I think, since Christmas.
No, but he's got that kind of energy in every game that other people don't have. Because if he's there, he tries to engage with the other team early, whereas Gilberto's always dropping off,
You mentioned briefly, Wenger coming and playing. We played that weakened team against United in the FA Cup, and it really cost them. And I think, similarly, in 2004, the Invincible season, where they played Man United in the FA Cup semi-finals with a weakened team, they ended up losing that, then they lost to Chelsea, and at that point they were up for the treble. And I think Wenger sometimes doesn't quite get it right. Well, Ferguson does seem to play these percentages better.
I just don't see United not failing to win that game. I just see two factors. Arsenal will be slower both in mind and in foot, and I just do not see them being able to contain Cristiano Ronaldo, Wayne Rooney on their game.
I think the point you're making, Sean, is when Wenger changes the lineup, he's bringing in markedly inferior players. Ferguson is not.
Yeah, very good point.
So he might want to spend some more money. Have we talked about that at all? Arsenal with a chance to go above Chelsea, though. Were they to get that unlikely win? Very good. We'll be turning our thoughts to matters foreign very, very shortly on Football Weekly Extra, so stay with us.
This is Guardian Football Weekly Extra.
All sorts of interesting things coming up, but first up, Sid Lowe on the line, quite literally, because you're on a train.
I am on a train, James, I'm going past some lovely countryside at the moment, just outside Tarragona.
Right, you're being serious, aren't you?
I am being serious.
It's lovely. Nice,
yeah.
And good. Where you've been to where?
I was at Barcelona's game last week in Schalke in the Champions League. I'm now on the train on my way back to Madrid.
All right, okay. And what did you make of Barcelona?
Well, I thought there were one or two patches in the second half where they looked pretty good. I thought Boyan looked very, very good on the right hand side. But all in all, it was another performance where Barca really didn't do anything to suggest that their crisis is behind them. They were up against it in the first half. I thought Schalke were the better side for most of that half, and the fans felt so too. There was a long period where Schalke kept the ball and played it around midfield, and the Barca fans started booing and whistling and going crazy. And then in the second half, obviously, once Barca got the goal, which was a little bit of a fluke from Yaya Toure. And after that, they settled a little bit, but they still don't look like a great side.
Yeah, and then when Boyan came off, there was plenty of white handkerchief waving.
Well, that's the amazing thing. I mean, the one positive thing of the whole night was Boyan's performance. I thought he was really very, very good indeed. And then Frank Rijkaard took him off. Now, obviously, there's two or three ways of looking at it. The first one is to say that Rijkaard's brave. He did the right thing, taking off a kid, protect his legs, give him the chance to get an ovation. But, of course, the way that people are emotionally at the moment in Barcelona, that was the worst thing could have done politically, because the one good player on the pitch, he took him off, and the fans went absolutely ballistic. Rijkaard was very interesting after the game, and said something that I thought was quite good. It's quite a nice way of having a go at the fans. He said, look, I don't mind you booing me, I don't mind people having a go at me, but it's not fair on Giovanni Dos Santos, who was the kid who was coming on. He said, this is an 18-year-old who gives everything for the club, he really fights, he really battles. What's he supposed to think when he comes onto the pitch to a backdrop of boos?
Sid, what's the mood in Barcelona in terms of the next game against Manchester United? Do they think they've got a chance, and how can they win that game?
Well, the truth is, I think right now Barcelona have no chance of winning it. I really do, and there's a very clear sense in Barcelona at the moment that truth be told, probably they wouldn't have got this far if the draw hadn't been so extraordinarily generous to them. You know, they played Celtic and Schalke both times with the Camp Nou advantage in the second leg. Not great size. And I actually think perhaps if Schalke had realised how poor Barcelona were earlier, they might well have been able to beat them, because certainly they had them against the ropes in the second half.
They had so many chances, yeah. But yeah, all the finishing power of a toddler with a plate of broccoli, to use a time-honoured expression. And this time, of course, against Man United will be playing the first leg at the Nou Camp.
Yeah, and I think that's an important difference. There's a feeling when you look at the Barcelona defence, you just think they really haven't got a hope against Cristiano Ronaldo and Tevez and so on.
Although Puyol's going to be suspended, which is surely good news for them.
Well, they think it's very bad news. Yeah. I think it's bad news if Puyol was going to play at right back. But the truth is, you know, we can kind of criticise Puyol, but you think, what are the alternatives? Marquez not being fit virtual year. Gabby Milito was left out last night to make sure he didn't get a yellow card. So, of course, the yellow card for the second leg is still a possibility in the semi-final. And he's very, very important to him. Lilian Thuram is getting slower and slower by the day. And it's such a shame, because Lilian Thuram was once a great player. He really isn't anymore. The one thing that Barcelona may feel stands them in good stead, and Frank Rijkaard was really frustratingly non-committal on this last night. This is a question that I asked him after the game, is that Barcelona have tended to struggle when teams have come to the Camp Nou and done the park the bus routine. I mean, I won't do that. I think there is a feeling in Barcelona that perhaps it may help them to have plays football, but allows their opponents to play a little bit as well. But as I say, Rijkaard last night just wouldn't bite on that and just said, no, I'm just looking forward to it being a great game.
Well, you know, when you look at Barcelona's squad, for all the trouble they've had this year, they do have the ingredient. There surely is a good game in them, no? If they can rouse themselves.
Of course there is, and particularly at the Camp Nou, because at the Camp Nou this year, for the most part, all right, they've had some poor games, and particularly of late. I mean, you know, bear in mind, this Barcelona squad's only won one in the last six in the league. But the Camp Nou, they are capable of turning up the ball better than most teams in Spain. And the big hope, of course, the one that everybody is kind of trying to keep quiet about because they don't want to jinx it, is Leo Messi. And when Leo Messi comes back, Barca are a different side who play with a different pace. They're much more direct. And I really do genuinely believe that if Leo Messi hadn't have picked up three or four sort of irritating muscle injuries over the last two or three years, he would be streets ahead as the best player in the world at the moment.
Is he due to be fit then? Is that the likelihood?
He certainly hopes he's fit. He's back in Barcelona. He went to Rosario in Argentina to do some of his early rehabilitation. He's back in Barcelona now, and he certainly hopes he'll be fit.
Very interesting. I should just point out that the gaps in Sid's words are not us deleting his bad language. That he is actually on a train and the connection is a bit bad. However, Raya Dunayevskaya says, although Sid Lowe always speaks in right sense, could you please have a word with him about his increasing use of profanities in his otherwise excellent vignettes? Raya Dunayevskaya has an impressionable 13-year-old nephew who loves the show, and he's probably a lot of other grotty little oiks, this is his expression, tuning into a fine work. Please think of the children, Sid. Let's move on.
Hello.
Sid, hello. Are you there?
I think I've lost you.
I'm still here.
I'm out of a tunnel.
Okay.
I'm back in one again. That's not
oh, dear.
Problem.
Sid, you're in a tunnel. Hello, Sid.
I can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, okay, good. Well, we'll hang on a second then. Listeners? Right, okay, good. Are you there? How's the tunnel going?
On that note,
well, indeed, there were one or two other things I wanted to talk to Sid about, like Getafe, and who are playing Bayern Munich, of course, tonight in the UEFA Cup. But I guess they can all wait till Monday as Sid enters another tunnel. So let's move on. Let's see, other posts here. Oh, there are a couple of questions. Mygo in Sydney in Australia says, does anybody know how many people actually listen to this podcast? Is there any way to find out, Sean Ingle?
The most that have listened, like most people that listen to us over a week, has been 378,000 people, but generally it's around 100,000 a week.
100, what, split over the two shows or per
Yeah, split over the two shows, roughly. I mean, sometimes it's a bit more, sometimes a bit less.
Right, OK. So what was that week that everybody tuned in for that one?
I think it was when McLaren went.
Right.
It wasn't when Rob Curling was in charge.
Yeah. Cuba Boy says, bad news for AC Jimbo, you lost out to silver-haired, buffoon-tongued moderator Bill O'Hurley in the RTE Sports Guy presenter. Well, that's rotten, that is. Although, Sean, you've got more exciting news
on
the awards,
haven't
you?
For some reason, we've been nominated for a Sony, which is apparently the Oscars of radio journalism, and not just in the podcast award, but in the overall sports broadcast, along with, you know, the big names like Fighting Talk and all the others, and we've somehow sneaked in.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Have you ever been nominated for an award, Jimbo?
I might have been.
Have you ever won anything?
No.
Trip to the Grosvenor House? You must have.
I have been to the Grosvenor House, but yes. There's no silverware on my mantelpiece. No. S2 Goon says, if a lot of people want a metal riff, hello S2 Goon again, why can't we have one? A democracy is not just for the Tibetans.
Paul Doyle's a big metal fan. He loves Norwegian death metal. Maybe when he comes back, we'll...
I can't see a death metal riff making its way into our intro, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
Maybe Moby?
Perhaps, hey. I'll just see what I can knock up. Sorry, I mean Moby can knock up. Hey, Optunes in Berlin says, with objection to the fact that I was referencing the very brilliant Kevin Keegan and how we were going to say sorry, and then Nout in the podcast... So he was rather upset about that. Mac and Maradona says he thinks the apology to the obviously brilliant Kevin Keegan was somewhat ironic. No, actually, I meant it, but then it was completely my fault. I completely forgot during the podcast to talk about the fact that Newcastle had won 3 on the bounce after all the nasty things we'd said, and clearly the Jordi Musar, etc. and so on, was having some kind of very positive impact on Tyneside. So let's talk about that now a bit, shall we, the Premier League? Because Newcastle this weekend are going to be against Portsmouth. What do you think their chances are of having a fourth straight win, Kevin McCarra?
I saw Portsmouth winning away in West Ham in midweek. I didn't see it, so I noticed the result, rather, which is quite impressive. I don't know. I think Newcastle have done well, as you'd expect, under Keegan with attacking, because Viduka's become fit, and not only that, he's contributed. And Obafemi Martins, who can be fantastic, has also been getting involved as well as Owen. So that gives him a great strike force. But I would suppose there'll be more pressure put on the defence at Portsmouth. Maybe a scoring draw.
You would think. You remember the last one when there were 4 goals scored in the opening quarter of an hour?
Yes.
So it looks that way. Jermaine Defoe, of course, on fire, and he was rested last weekend. 4 goals in 7 starts.
Well, he was cup-tied.
Well, no, I mean rested. He didn't play.
Yes.
Obviously, I knew he was cup-tied. Goodness sake. Right, OK. Elsewhere, should we do some more Premier League? Or shall I briefly mention Serie A? No, we'll do a bit more Premier League.
You can mention Serie A.
Oh, go on then. I'll mention Serie A. 3 big games, you see, this weekend. Italy, Inter are at the top, 4 points clear. 6 weeks ago, they were 11 points clear. It's down to 4. They're taking on Fiorentina this weekend. Mm. Oof. Although Fiorentina have lost on their last 5 visits to the San Siro to face Inter. Roma, meanwhile, are facing an almost as tricky, if not trickier, fixture away to Udinese, who recently beat Fiorentina, took them apart, actually. And Totti, of course, still probably not fit. 50-50 is described as. You have to wonder how Roma's morale is going to be after their exit at Old Trafford, and De Rossi's in particular, after his appalling, which I think nobody was particularly surprised. Did you see his face as he was going up to take the kick? He looked sick. But, yeah, so Roma, how well they're going to bounce back from that, because it was a bit of a shattering blow. And I must admit, watching, and I think this is something that other people have mentioned too, watching the game, or the games against Man United, you do begin to wonder, Francesco Totti not in those games. Now, several key matches in the last couple of years that he's missed, and the injuries beginning to pile up. He's, what, 32 now? And you start to think, my word, that, you know, we're actually almost at the post-Totti phase in Roma's in Roma's history. You know, what are they going to be like without him? It is a major issue, because there's no way they could go out and buy a player like that on their current finances. Although, James Dott, you were just asking about this American chap who supposedly is coming into... apparently he's instructed Rothschild to perform due diligence, as Kevin explains that it's called, and examine their accounts, which will make some very interesting reading, probably. And so there's this idea in Rome that he, not Tom Hicks, or there was another person mentioned as well, but this guy George Soros, who's worth about $7 billion, might be coming in to buy up Roma, which would certainly... Yeah.
Jimbo, I was just going to ask you about the fight for the Champions League spots, because it's all getting very interesting.
Isn't
I mean,
it?
You know, you've got Juve, Milan, you've got Sampdoria, you know, I think a very interesting line making.
They're level on points with Milan.
Late bid. And where do you see it going? Because you were sort of writing off Juve a while ago, and they're still They're still
no, Juve are going to hang on by looks. So I've just pulled out the sheet of paper here. You've got Inter on 72, Roma on 68, 4 points behind. A whopping great gap down to Juve in third on 58. And then Fiorentina in the fourth spot are 2 points behind them on 56. Then you have Milan and Sampdoria, 4 points behind them on 52. And Udinese, 51. So it is very, very tight. The accepted notion is that Milan are going to pull it together. Kaká came back last weekend and made a very big difference to them. And, you know, they do have, you would think, the big game experience to actually, you know, pull this together in the last, what, six games of the season.
Is their running easier, Milan's, or do they have any tough ones, or do we know?
Well, this weekend, no, it's not, because they're away to Juventus. Dun, dun, dun. Yes, these two teams have won 13 of the last 16 titles, not including the ones that have been stripped from Juventus, just in case you're wondering. And that's going to be a big, big test.
You're so well informed.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Milan do have a very fine record because they've been rubbish at home, basically. They've done all right away. And Kaká's back, as I say. So I think most people are actually thinking they might pull off the result there. No. OK. Berlusconi, meanwhile, we mentioned on Monday that the fans are saying don't bring back Shevchenko. Berlusconi, who I think is having his elections this weekend, the general elections, is it? Yeah, he said, yeah, Shevchenko's definitely coming back and we might bring Ronaldinho too. I mean, the important thing, obviously, you get Sheva back, because that's really going to make a difference. Fami De Lupo, which means really hungry, says, wonder if Jimbo could throw some light on why Mario Balotelli is able to play for Inter in Serie A at the age of 17, whereas Pato had to wait until he was 18 to make his Milan debut. Pato and My Name Is Here, My Name Here, is all had a pop at this one as well. But the thing was that because Pato was transferred from somewhere else, the transfer wasn't allowed to go through until he was 18, and that happened after the transfer window closed, so they had to wait for the next transfer window to open before they could deposit his contract. With Balotelli, it's a different thing because basically he was within the system, so he just comes straight into the ranks. In the same way that Paolo Maldini did when he was 16 for Milan.
Can I just ask you about the ongoing Inter manager situation? Because we've talked to him in the past and in the pod about you think he's off to Inter. But
Mourinho?
Yeah. But someone, you know, reasonably close to the Mourinho camp.
Says Barcelona?
No. Says that he's leveraging Inter and really wants to go to Real Madrid.
All right, because I heard he was leveraging Inter because he really wanted to go to Barcelona. Nobody really knows, but it was interesting how his press agent, of all people, came out with all these stories about how he'd been in speaking to Inter's president, and he'd been in Milan, and he wouldn't even have gone to Milan if the talks weren't already at a highly developed stage. And then a day later, Mourinho says, oh, of course that didn't happen. I don't know where that story comes from. It came from your press agent. So I don't know. It does sound very strange. However, I think they would be delighted if you were to go there to Inter. You have to figure that Massimo Moratti is one of the few presidents crazy enough to keep Mancini on, despite his I'm out of here a rant the other day. That's probably enough for Italian stuff for now. James Dart, you've got a big bundle of championship stuff to talk to us about, have you not?
I do indeed, yes.
It's a bizarre league.
It is. Well, we talked about this last season, saying that it was the most exciting league around, and I think it's retained that title once again this year. You've got the top five all separated by 2 points. West Brom moved up from fifth to first in midweek with a 3-1 win at Blackpool. And from top to bottom, there's 34 points from first to the bottom. And, I mean, compare that to the Premier League, where it's 66. I know Derby is not a great example, or League One, where it's 50 or so. But it's incredibly, incredibly tight. I mean, you look from 22nd up to 17th in the final relegation spot, 3 points separating it. Leicester currently in that spot, which would be a huge blow for Milan manager, which is millions.
Yeah, because they had the best defence, or they had the best defence, didn't they?
Well, no, they have a defence of... They've conceded 41 goals this season, and only Crystal Palace, by my calculations, have conceded fewer, just 40. And their goal difference is -2. You look at second place at the moment, Bristol City, goal difference of 0. They've only scored 49 goals. Very few teams have scored anywhere as few as them. And, I mean, it's a very rare thing. I'm looking back here. Apparently, in the 1998 Swedish Championship, AIK won the title, scoring 25 goals in 26 games. All of the other 13 teams in the division scored more, including those relegated teams, but AIK still won the title. So,
well, it's not just the scoring, it's the fact that there's a negative goal. They're now on 0, I think.
Mm-hmm, they are.
But until, from last weekend, they were minus and they were top of the table. Amazing.
Well, yes. I mean, you've got West Brom at the top, and I do think West Brom are going to just about sneak their way through. I mean, they've scored 81 goals. They've got the most firepower in the shape of Kevin Phillips, and Ismael Miller's been scoring a few goals in the division as well. I think they're just about going to crawl over the line, although there's an awful lot of huge fixtures in the run-in. I mean, I look at this weekend, you've got Bristol City versus Wolves, West Brom against Watford, then Wolves, West Brom, Stoke, Bristol City, Wolves, Ipswich, Wolves, Cardiff. It's a fantastic run-in
for
the end of the season.
It was Russell Wilde done last night too, with Watford could have gone top and they lose 3-0.
3-0, and they even let KO De Gea score twice. I mean, after his FA Cup semi final.
It was a cracking goal.
It was.
The miss was pretty special as well, that he failed to get his hat trick with. But they bounced back well then, Barnsley, because they were in the relegation zone. Are they now out of that?
A huge, huge lift for the Tigers. I mean, up to 18th now. And I mean, it's going to go to the final day of the season when you've got fixtures like Stoke against Leicester, which will have serious connotations at both ends of the table. Yeah. Blackpool, Watford, QPR, West Brom, and potentially Wolves, Plymouth, possibly for that last playoff spot.
But we shouldn't be that surprised about, you know, excitement and teams that we don't expect being at the top of the table, because until 15, 20 years ago, that happened in, you know, Division 1 as it was back then.
Right.
You know, you had Norwich, you had Ipswich finishing second, you had, you know, West Ham mate on a chair. You know, a running for the title, and it's just because the obvious thing is that there's no super rich team in the Championship. There's no super poor team. Well, there's one or two that are struggling. You know, it's a hell of a lot different than the Premiership, and it's more exciting and more unpredictable.
You are a conflicted individual, aren't you, Sean? On one hand,
tortured.
You're yearning for the good old days, but on the other hand, it's video evidence this and technology that.
I don't, those two things aren't contradictory.
Right. Okay.
Are they? Explain to me why they are.
You must like steampunk. Do you know steampunk?
No.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Tell me about them.
Oh, steampunk. No, steampunk is a genre of literature, which I haven't read much of, but it basically... Kevin, you nodding. Have you read
this
much
this
of this?
This is the historical stuff of a science fiction.
Yeah, it's basically as if, you know... I tell you what, you know, a lot of...
Alternative history and so on.
Yeah, if science had developed along, you know, steam power as opposed to... I mean, his Dark Materials, etc., a lot of that is, I mean, not steampunk, but there are similar ideas in that there is, you know, an alternative technology, the development, if an alternative technology had been developed instead of the one that we have.
Speaking of Philip Pullman, do you get tired that by the third book he's preaching atheism in a way that's as annoying as having religion preached
at you? But, you know, I don't take that from that third book at all. I don't see it as an atheist book. I see what he's saying is that the power or the source of, you know, force in the universe has been sequestered by various figures who want to act as a kind of intermediaries, and they get destroyed, but there is always a force behind it. How can you have atheism in a universe where there's dust?
No, but all I really mean is being beaten over the head by him. You feel you're being hectored by him.
It's a very disappointing
third
book.
Misses.
But that's also because he sets the bar so high with that incredible first book.
What did you make of the film? You were disappointed by it, weren't you?
Incredibly disappointed. If there are listeners still out there considering in any way having any kind of involvement with that film, run now.
He's got a new book coming out very soon, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I can see fighting talk running together at this moment.
but there you go. Now, there you go. That is the Coca-Cola Championship. And Plymouth, how are they doing?
They've bombed, unfortunately. But they could still get in, given that all the teams above them keep drawing and slipping up. So they could still sneak in.
All right, yeah, excellent. Well, we best move on to part three then very shortly, where we'll discuss the remaining games in the Premier League this weekend.
The Guardian Football Weekly Extra Podcast.
Sean, you got your racing post there. And let's see, we've got a big fixture list here. I'm looking for some top tips to supplement my meagre earnings. Derby County, Aston Villa, eh? Derby County, they still need 4 points. And how many games to go? 5? You know, to avoid being the worst ever, etc., etc., etc.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen, okay. They've gone 27 Premier League games without a win. That's a new Premier League record.
I thought losing 1-0 to Everton was quite encouraging, mind you, last week. <wasn't
it>? Everton.
I'm not serious, it wasn't that bad. Was it?
Everton were really, really poor. And it's a great shame, because Everton, with a very small squad, have done ever so well.
Didn't you think, Sean, that pass was wasted in that game? What a fantastic ball it was for the only goal.
I'm quite interested, if we can go off on a little tangent, on what David Moyes will do this summer, because you know, we've said before how he divides Everton fans. He's a bit of a control freak. I was chatting to a guy who may provide some of the statistics for Everton and all the data, and he was saying that he was in America trying to sell this data to, you know, American sports teams, and one of the examples he gave was comparing Everton with Liverpool and the different ways of playing. And he was telling me that somehow David Moyes got hold of this, and next time he was at Everton, he collared him and said, "Oi, I hear you've been, you know, telling people about how we play, and you said that we're a long ball team." And he said he was actually quite scared, because Moyes was this
scary guy.
Powerful man. Has he ever given you a stern talking to?
Not at all. I once spoke to him about his early days at Celtic when he played right back. That was the only conversation we ever had. Right. And that didn't last all that long as a conversation.
Everton are at Birmingham City this weekend. Who are doing pretty well at home, at least. And obviously, you need points because they're not out of the relegation picture yet.
Obviously, we because of legal reasons, we can't go too much into it. But Cameron Brady and David Sullivan have been arrested overall,
and bailed.
And you wonder how that may or may not affect. This weekend.
Everton, of course, if they win, I think go level with Liverpool, do they not? Because Liverpool aren't going to play until Sunday when they're at home to Blackburn, who are a tricky team.
They are. I mean, I think Liverpool, in the last six games, they scored 16 goals, so they're on fantastic form. But Blackburn, one of these teams that are very difficult to break down, and they normally do quite well against Liverpool, certainly at home, maybe not so much.
Well, they're not usually facing Fernando Torres. All right, well, quickly whistling through the other games then. Ooh, now, we mentioned that Newcastle were aiming for their fourth in a row, so are their northeastern neighbours Sunderland, who are hosting Man City, and thus, I would posit, have a greatly advantageous position while going for it.
Thinking that Man City will perk up, and they keep on failing to do so. Last week against Chelsea, another example. I think 50,000 euphoric fans should be a win for Sunderland.
I'm getting increasingly worried. James and I have our bet with Barry that we can't mention.
I haven't bet anything. It's Barry and you.
Yeah, no, I've said James and I, Dart and I.
Sorry, James.
Have backed Manchester City to finish in the top 10. Right. And I think, Barry is probably...
They're not going to...
They are. They should still do it.
It's going to be like when I did the marathon. Like, they'll be crawling over the line, basically. So.
They've won just two of their last 12 Premier League matches. They've failed to score in five of their last seven.
They're lucky because Spurs and West Ham are just treading water as well, and no one's going to overtake them, fortunately. For myself,
how did you get on with the marathon? Because it's this weekend.
I actually beat Mark Hughes by 3 minutes.
Did you?
Yeah, but I was still about 5 hours, 20 minutes or something.
When did you do the marathon?
About 2003.
Oh, nice. Did you see Sparky?
No, I wish I had. I think it was my final kick. Must have left him for dust. But,
Impressive.
Final limp, yeah.
Now, speaking of final kicks, Reading are almost out of trouble and Fulham desperately need points. They have gone 33 Premier League away games without a win. This is a fantastic stats page I printed out here. 33 Premier League games away without a win. They're at Reading and Reading have taken 7 points from the last three home games. Case closed.
I think just about the end for Fulham.
Yeah. Okay. What else? Bolton Wanderers, West Ham... Bolton in trouble?
They are, though. They're lucky. I mean, West Ham are one of these teams that you look at their players and think they should be doing a little bit better than they are. They seem to have, packed up once they got knocked out of the FA Cup. And Bolton might win that. But, as I said before, I want Bolton to go down because of the way they treated the UEFA Cup. And I think Megson will go at the end of the season no matter what. We said it would be...
How do you want people to go down? That's terrible, Sean.
Yeah, well...
My stats page says that Bolton have taken just 1 point from the last 24 available. Worrying statistics. Spurs, speaking of packing up, against Middlesbrough, who have just obviously caused a bit of a scare with United. 74 goals have been scored at White Hart Lane this season, more than at any other ground.
I think we should just, dump some of us and get your stats page in a bit more often.
Stats
weekly. We should get Stephen Hawking's voice computer, and he can just
speak. What was the name of that fantastic spelling thing?
Speaking
that
spell?
That is correct. I think it was, actually. Yeah. We're going to have lost all five of the last Premier League games against Chelsea, blah, 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 blah. Chelsea, they don't lose at home. They're not going to lose this one, etc.
A narrow, tedious win for Chelsea.
All right, then. Any other business, people? No? Really? Nothing at all?
Best of luck to Rangers tonight.
Yes. Big game. Well, you may well be at the other side of that result by the time you hear this, listeners. It may well have already have taken place. But it will be, I'm sure, featuring in some way in our Monday podcast. Apologies if we missed your question to Sid. Do send them in again, which is the safest way of me having them for Monday when we return. In the meantime, many, many thanks to Sean Ingle.
Thank you, James.
Not at all, James Darr.
Cheers, James.
And to Kevin McGarra.
Thank you, James.
And producer Patrick. We will return on Monday. Hopefully you will too, listeners. For now, bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.